The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. This week's Zero Books podcast is a conversation between me, Tom O'Brien of the Alpha to Omega podcast, and Zero Books reader C. Derek Varn. We're discussing what everyone is discussing, that is, the surprising defeat of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, and the election of reality TV star and tycoon Donald Trump. It's Wednesday, November 9th, 2016. I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books, and I didn't see this coming. I should take a moment to thank our Zero Books Club members. Now is a good time to support Zero Books and left publishing in general. And one way to do that is to sign up to be a Zero Books Club member and receive our weekly Inside Zero Books podcast. You can find a link to our membership page in this week's show notes. There are no excerpts or music this week, just an hour and 40 minutes of conversation on the ramifications of the election of Trump.
Hello and welcome to this special U.S. presidential election edition. First time we've done a live edition, first time I've ever done any show that has any kind of current affairs to it at all that's even slightly temporally relative. So we have a Doug Lane who and C. Derek Farn on the call tonight, both regulars from the podcast. Doug, would you like to tell us about how you experience finding out the news that the Donald is our new Uber Emperor?
Yes. So yesterday I went to get a benign cyst removed from my chest, and they numbed me up and cut out the cyst. All the while, actually, the doctor was taking breaks from removing the cyst to go and check the election results on the computer in the room. When I got home, I watched the election results, and just as the news came in that Trump was looking good, that he was winning the Rust Belt, the numbing agent wore off, and I started to feel this pain in my across my chest, really on my skin, and feel the stitches, and realize I had been cut. I mean, I hadn't really noticed it until that moment, and so I spent the evening. And some little bit of pain, not the worst pain ever, but it seemed to go hand in hand with the pain of realizing that this secret dark fantasy had actually come true.
Yeah, it's quite a dark fantasy. Derek, how did you hear the news?
I woke up at, 5 o'clock in the morning after a nice long sleep that I have not had in a long time. And check the polls and was mildly surprised, although not actually very surprised. I was not nearly surprised as everyone else. Didn't have breakfast.
I know I've done it. I told you so on my Facebook page, but I'm a very pessimistic man, so I can take that with a pinch of salt. Derek, do you want to give an I told you so now?
I'm going to be fair. I've been calling a lot of this stuff against the Democrats for about 3.5 years because I don't think I've really been listening to the discontent with them. And I also think they've been misreading it, fairy stories to themselves about what's actually going on, that it's all racism and sexism, which I'm not going to lie, definitely plays a part. You can't deny that. But why is it that 60% of the Latino vote in Florida went for Trump? Why is it that in general, in the entire United States, Trump got more Latino votes than Romney? Why is it, the fear of Trump and the near apocalyptic rhetoric that's been used for the past 3 months not get black voters to come out in force.
Well, so, yeah. I think.
Well, can I jump in and I can't say I told you so because I officially congratulated President-elect Clinton the day before the election on my Facebook wall, which I'm sure I thought she would appreciate at the time. Now probably it's bitter for her. We're close. But I want to ask Derek a question, which is, why is it, do you think, that the rhetoric, the apocalyptic rhetoric around Trump didn't get the black vote out the way you might expect it would?
Because they didn't see them. They didn't see a lot. Well, I'm not going to say that. A lot of the black community, particularly in the South, did not see enough of an incentive for itself to be encouraged to vote. And Clinton just assumed that they were going to vote against Trump and that she didn't put anything on the table for them.
What might she have put on the table for them?
Yeah, I really don't know. Urban renewal projects, something like that. I mean, I don't feel like here's the thing about this whole election. This has been the most issueless discussion about an election in a lot of ways that I've ever heard.
When you say issueless, you mean just everybody saying he's a racist and he's a misogynist and there's no policy discussion.
Yeah, and that Russia's going to, you know, purge the election and the third party's going to cost him the vote.
Well,
I mean, there's...
Well, I think it was actually quite a lot of issues talked, but there was only one person talking about them, and that was Donald Trump. Because all the issues that he won on, like trade and immigration and things like that, and say Wall Street, that... Hillary she can't talk about them. So
right.
she couldn't talk about them, but he could. She was like the perfect negative candidate for him. You know, they couldn't have picked a better candidate to go up against him.
And what's ironic about that is she is part of why he's a candidate in the first place.
Right.
The Podesta emails make it very clear they were leaking info to the press to try to get them to focus on what would quote unquote fringe candidates, the establishment, because they thought they would be easier trying to build a straw race. I mean, I don't know how unself-aware you have to be. Like, talk about tone deaf.
Well, I think they
played everything wrong.
I think they made a calculated decision, Derek. I think they were...
It was a stupid calculated decision.
Derek, do you have any headphones at all? We're getting a bit of feedback. I don't know if you have.
Sure, give me a second, I'll get some.
Okay. Yeah, like, just to continue, Doug, I think it was an extremely calculated decision that they knew explicitly what they were trying to do, and they thought the way the establishment could get their establishment character through, you know, nominee true, was this way of bigging up the boogeyman.
Right. I think that, you know, look, if you read the Podesta emails, it's not even speculation. They admitted to themselves in various emails that the only candidate that Hillary Clinton appeared to be able to beat at all, that she would have any chance with, would be someone like Trump. That's at least that was their estimation. And I think that if, say, Rubio or Bush, Jeb Bush, had run, that Clinton might have won. I mean, Clinton might have lost, just as she did, but in a way which was far less damaging, not just because we got Trump out of this deal, but also because it would be far less damaging to the Democratic Party and to whatever remains of the left to be opposed to a candidate who wasn't apocalyptic. I mean, to put this much energy into opposing the villain and to lose is demoralizing in profound ways. I just hope that out of it we can start to think about, you know, like what role we all played in in helping this to happen, and where things have gone wrong in the, say, the last, 10 years, really, but certainly in the last 4 years, on the left, and how we've created echo chambers for ourselves so that we don't understand or don't see what's happening nationally or to people who aren't like ourselves. I mean, there's often an accusation made that people on the right just don't care about people who aren't just like them. But I think that that kind of holds across the spectrum.
I think you're probably wrong in the last 4 or 10 years. It's probably the last 5,000 years. But Derek, do you mind muting when you're not talking? Because we're getting a little bit of feedback still. But I think, I've lost my train of thought now. Let me just, what was I going to say? You butt in now, Doug. I'm after my mind just went completely blank.
Well, I was going to say something about the way demographics work in our elections. Yeah. And say something to Varn about how I think that the black vote in the United States isn't fundamentally different from any other bloc, which is that that people are voting out of what they perceive to be their interest, or how maybe for candidates who they recognize as being like them or representing them or somehow embodying their values or speaking to them. But I don't know if I don't think anybody in this last election was thinking in a rational way about what was in their actual interest. I just, like, Obama didn't have to promise any kind of urban renewal projects in order to get a huge turnout of the black vote. I'll stop there.
Well, of course he didn't.
Right.
I mean, this is kind of silly.
Right.
But if you think our democracy should be run like Lebanon, then go ahead. This is the issue here when you assume that representation and narrative is going to be what drives an election. Is seen as naturally representing back interest. Did he? Well, our friends at the Black Agenda Report say definitely no.
Right.
It seems strange to me.
What are you going to do about that?
It seems strange to me that we had a return of policy to the table. I know you said initially the opposite, but I think, you know, Trump actually brought policy among all the racism and misogyny and everything else he brought. He brought actual hardcore anti-establishment policies, whether he's going to follow through on them or not. Like, it didn't feel like there wasn't a choice in this election. I don't know what people make of that.
Oh, there was a real choice. There was a real choice. But the thing is, the real choice was basically a giant troll. I mean, it's not that Trump doesn't have policies. He does. He definitely does. He had policy papers. They were real. Liberal wonks would tear them apart, but they didn't put out anything counter to them. You know, you could have Vox after Vox thing about it. And also, Trump revised his opinion. Now, some of that was cynical because he's trying to maintain a fairly big block. And he's put a lot of establishment people in his cabinet, apparently, as we're beginning to find out. But
I've got a question for the two of you.
Okay.
I was watching something there today. I was watching some stuff through from a Democracy Now, their live election program, all 5 or 6 hours of it. But they were, one of the people on that was talking about how a lot of people who voted for Obama in the last two elections have switched and voted for Trump this time. That's an interesting.
Yeah, and that speaks to the fact that it's not about policies. It's about a perception of the candidate represents some sort of radical change or is going to shake up the establishment. Or, you know, the reason why, if you voted for Obama 4 to 8 years ago and you might vote for Trump now, it's not suddenly that you've decided that you're a racist. And it's not because you've looked at Trump's policy papers and said, oh, yeah, these all seem right to me. It's because you were fed up with the Bush administration 8 years ago. You thought something that was completely different than that, that looked completely different than that, needed to be put into power. And now you've been given that for 8 years, and you're fed up with the kind of milquetoast liberal establishment, and you're willing to throw in you know, Pepe the Frog to mess up the establishment this time.
Well, sorry, Derek, you fire ahead.
Go ahead. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of what's going on. I also think there's a whole lot going on with the liberal declamations of people actually being self-fulfilling, whereas, you know, I think Clinton's long speech about the alt-right, for example, was the biggest gift ever given to that group. Now, I've followed them for almost 10 years before they were even called that, I think. I'm not quite sure when Richard Spencer gave them that label. It was probably around 2007, 2008. I know it's after he fell out with the American Conservative magazine when Pat Buchanan was the editor. But they are now a real thing in the American consciousness that, I know, everyone thought I was crazy for studying for years.
Right. I definitely agree with you that she made a – that not only Clinton, but the liberals who call themselves part of the left, the race and gender-oriented liberals have been creating or helping to create. They're not the only forces behind it, but they've been boosting, you know, and treating – alt-right characters as serious for, you know, I guess 8 years or longer, and to some extent this is a result. And I'm going to say something crazy and maybe a little bit trivial, but I was surprised at how closely, I mean, not beat for beat, but fairly closely, this election matched the tone and even the framing of the Gamergate scandal. You know, it was just astounding to me that, you know, in a way you could look at Trump as like the Gamergate candidate.
What is the Gamergate? Can you talk about that again?
Oh, it was all about ethics.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I'll just say it very briefly. But, you know, there was a video game developer who had some sort of sex scandal, and it became a big controversy in a Twitter war because the establishment of video game journalism kind of circled the wagons around her and started to attack their own readers and commenters as misogynists because they were critical of this one game developer who had a sex scandal. And it blew up and became a kind of a culture war, mostly on Twitter and other places. But then, you know, it got picked up by all these big mainstream media organs like The New Yorker and CNN and just a variety of places you wouldn't expect to be that concerned about video games. And basically what I still think of from my slacker, you know, Gen X perspective is a bunch of trolls on bulletin boards. But it became a small-scale cultural war. And a lot of the rhetoric, you know, was picked up by the Trump campaign. You know, he ran against the media. He ran against the corrupt liberal social justice warrior establishment.
Yeah, like I think that, like, he had, like, personally, I think a lot of people were actually driven by his policies. Like, if you look at what his major three or four policies were, one is to redo the crumbling infrastructure, right? Everybody wants that. That's a big thing. Two, to build the wall. Okay, Now, not very many people will go for that, but it does play into the racism thing. Three, free trade, bring back and industrialize the things. I think a lot of people looking at them three, I think there is three main ones to me. And also four, a less interventionist foreign policy. Parts of that, Donald has this great tactic where he says both sides of the thing, but those three were quite consistent. Now, I think most people would agree with two of them, you know, infrastructure, reindustrialize, and a lot of people were prepared to hold their nose on the third one, the racist one. And I think probably a lot of people don't think he'll be able to carry it through.
Reindustrializing was to impose tariffs and get better trade deals with our allies.
Yes,
right, and absolutely. That would bring the jobs back. That would bring jobs back to the United States. That was his plan. And then the infrastructure was, I mean, I didn't see any policy positions or...
The first thing, Doug, he said today in his acceptance speech, the first policy thing he said today was to redo our infrastructure. And he also has been talking about, you know, increasing military spend. And to me, I think a lot of people are looking at that and they're sitting in Ohio or wherever the hell they are in some old Rust Belt place. And they're thinking, he might bring the jobs back. He's the only candidate since Ross Perot who said, bring the jobs back. Literally the only candidate. And they go, we'll vote for him and we'll hold our nose on the racism. And I think that is a lot of it. Like, I hate to see, like, after I've been in England going through all the Brexit, and you see how a lot of people are saying people are stupid or stupid or stupid. The people who vote, look at where the areas are that voted for Brexit. It was all the ones that got decimated by the neoliberal policies and deindustrialization. And look at who voted for Donald Trump this time. All the swing states, as far as I could see, were Rust Belt. The major ones were Rust Belt, or a good few of them were.
The South, and they thought the South was actually closer than they thought because of the minority vote, but not nearly enough. And beyond that, all those areas have been, economically hit. I think economically devastated. You know, I'm from Georgia. I'm from a part of Georgia that has not yet seen a recovery from the 2002 recession. I'm actually not even kidding. So. Jobs are never coming back. The only thing holding the economy there afloat at all is military Keynesianism. And even that's been waning for the past 20 years because it's been more and more centralized in certain areas through the congressional pork spending and all this. We shouldn't be surprised that Trump is going to offer a lot of stuff on infrastructure. I mean, look what sector of the bourgeoisie comes out of. He comes out of real estate development. He understands that.
Exactly. And that's a very important thing because he's a part of he does not trade in commodities, bring them across international borders. He doesn't give a damn about like the free trade. The free trade doesn't really affect him. You know, he's building real estate and that's going to be used by the people who are near, you know, generally who live near that area. You know, maybe some direct foreign investment, but it's not, he's not like making iPhones in China and bringing them. That's where he's made his money. So like, it's a very important thing to understand why he can be for tariffs and why he can make that as a billionaire, he can make that decision because it doesn't really affect his bottom line.
I was going to jump in. I don't disagree with that at all. Really. I want to point out that I don't think that Trump's policies have much of a shot at all of having the kinds of positive effects that he's claiming. The infrastructure spending, can happen when you have a solid fiscal basis for the spending, and we don't. We have a fiscal crisis or on the verge of one, have been for the last 8 years. The other thing. And the tariffs, I think that there are lots of unintended consequences to what he's suggesting there. But just to draw back to the cultural side of this, the problem for the left was, one, we're backing, the so-called left was backing a candidate who, you're right, couldn't speak to these issues in any way that was serious, because all Clinton was going to do is say, yeah, just grin and bear it, basically. This is the best of all possible worlds. And the actual left had no desire to really speak to these issues deeply. And even those that did wouldn't be heard because there was this cultural divide that makes it almost impossible to even talk to anyone who isn't just like you or who isn't, if you're on the coast. You're not even going to be heard probably by most of the people in the Rust Belt.
I think that's totally by design. And I think that, that Donald Trump is the end game of that long-term political, system. You know, this idea, there's a political game going on that the Democrats can shift to the right and shift slowly to the right and the Republicans go further to the right. But, you know, it's like a coil. you know, a spring coil. It'll oscillate back to another configurement when you get to a certain point. And this point could have been a Democrat could have done it, like Bernie, or it could have been, you know, a kind of a racist neo-fascist populist like Trump. But that, to me, that's the end game of the system, how it was set up. The idea that when Barack Obama went into office, it was all about stimulate the economy to make sure it doesn't completely collapse. And the minute they stimulated to such an extent to revive it, then they decided to do austerity. You know, these things, and, you know, Obama sold people down the line, and they look to this hope change. What was it that the, you know, what was it Sarah Palin said? You know, what about this hopey change and stuff? How's that doing for you? You know, that's she was dead right. You know,
well, I don't think when you break it down, they've been, well, they do think people are fools. They're trying to sell us for the last 2 years. And yes, there have been jobs coming back. They've been incredibly lower paying. The average income has gone down. The amount of people out of the job market altogether and are no longer counted. The employment roles has gone up dramatically. Some of that is aging. Some of that is also people in staying school forever, causing part of the student debt crisis, which even though the student debt crisis is somewhat overreported, that's also bubbling. I don't know what they really expected. This is where I'm sort of frustrated with the entire friggin' spectrum. And, you know, the left isn't willing to oppose the Democrats on shit. Not really. When push comes to shove, they wouldn't even risk Trump. And because they wouldn't even risk Trump, they got him anyway. And the reasons for that are complicated, but it has a lot to do with the fact that they're not culturally that different from Democrats themselves. They're basically from the same white collar professional class. And I'll be honest with you, you know, where I'm from, there aren't any Marxists, and where I'm from, you know, there's like five people in BLM, and it's a majority black area now. Yeah, I live in Cairo, but I still go home. I still talk to those people. And I've been trying to tell liberals and leftists both to shut the fuck up and listen to them for years. And they have not done it. I mean, you can hear the anger in my voice because I really am angry at them. Them, more than the right.
Well, yeah. Okay, well, how can you overcome that cultural, first of all, okay, a couple of things. the first thing is, I don't think that Trump...
Hey, wait, sorry, one thing I just want to say is that, sorry, Doug, to talk across here, is that, you know, we're talking about culture the whole time here, and we're Marxists. Just want to point that out.
I know. Okay, but that's the thing that we've been... I feel like this election has forced me to think about culture again in a way I don't like. But, okay, what was I going to say? I was going to say, first of all, I don't think that the election of Trump represents any kind of coordinated, conscious, by design effort to bring Trump into power or to try a fascist solution by the establishment in the, you know, the bourgeois establishment. This is a big fucking mistake that's happened. So, and from their perspective, the second thing is, I want to just say something to Derek, and then.
But that's fascist. Go ahead.
Can I go on? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get leftists to listen. First of all, get anyone to listen is really tough right now because we're all in our little cocoons and bubbles, and all we do is talk about ourselves all the time. You know, on social media and such, and that includes, I think that includes, you know, people in the deep South as much as it includes coastal latte sipping fucks like myself. But I think it's fair to be angry at the liberals and the left right now. But I'm not angry at the people in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and wherever the hell, Ohio, that made this happen. But I do think that, those people made a big mistake. And I think that big mistake, and the figuring out how to talk to people and listen to them and be listened to is a huge part of what any left project should be about right now.
Let's try to be good Marxists for a second and talk about what class options really were, because we are getting bogged down in culture. But like, I was trying to get into this a bit with the whole class analysis thing. With the bourgeoisie, people don't think about the bourgeoisie being different and divided amongst itself and different sectors being very different, because they don't think about class really. Even Marxists in the main don't really seem to. It's an abstraction that they throw around, that they talk about the working class and they talk about the bourgeoisie, and they don't know who they are. You get some bullshit about the precariat or industrial workers who don't exist, or we'll get in debates about labor aristocracy with very poorly defined terms. I mean, this is always the way it goes, because this has not been truly dealt with in a sense where you had to go out and really learn it. Part of the reason why it hasn't happened, though, and something really do need to talk about that's deep history for the left, is that when they did attempt this in the 60s and 70s to really go out into the workforce, it totally blew up in their face. It didn't go anywhere. They couldn't talk to in the unions, they complained about them being reactionary. They were mostly just Democrats, to be frank. But they couldn't get any headway with them.
Well, the thing is, back then, the people that did that, I would guess, were still tied somewhat to the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So you're talking about a situation then where the workers who didn't want to talk to those people weren't being stupid at all. You know, those people.
No, I'm not saying they were either.
Yeah, right. I mean, those people had a line of shit to sell them that they didn't want to buy, and good for them that they didn't.
Well, I must jump in here. Like, Doug, you said earlier that it was a total and utter royal fuck up by the establishment to have Donald in. And I don't really see it that way, to be honest with you. I think that when the establishment had their choice, you know, they had their choice between look who on the polls, who was the most dominant person against Trump. It was Bernie. He was miles ahead. When they put them head to head, he was trouncing Donald. Hillary was neck and neck. And they were willing to risk. This is like, just look into the history of the 20th century, they were willing to risk a neo-fascist instead of a moderate left guy. Like, remember, like...
Okay, but wait a minute. Let me just jump in. I got to jump in here. First of all...
I'm not finished yet, though. I know, but
okay, finish your point.
Yeah, sorry. So, like, if you think about back to the 1930s, the only time in American history where they actually ended up getting a left government in, FDR, you know, whatever you want to call it, FDR, Social Democrat, whatever.
Left.
Yeah, it was, you know, I'm not saying he was radical.
Quotation mark.
Yeah, exactly. But like, the Labour Party in England did redistribution of... And they brought in certain good things. The last one was FDR. And that took like a World War, you know, a Great Depression.
And the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, the Communists, the Spanish Revolution. It took all of these things happening at that time to get FDR. And they look at now, and how weak the left is at the moment is that our version of the Soviet Union or whatever is like Bernie Sanders, you know? Okay. And they looked at it and they went, we're willing to risk.
Yeah, can I jump in now?
With Trump.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Okay,
now, all right, here's the thing.
But it's my show, Doug. It's my show. I should be able to talk. No, I'm joking.
All right. Yeah, no, okay, but here's the thing. It's not as though the DNC and the RNC are the same people, okay? I mean, it's not that they even represent the same interests within capitalism. They don't, not entirely. And look, it's not that the RNC, like, wanted Trump, or the DNC thought they could beat Trump. Clinton and the DNC did try to help him. But the main point here is that the Democratic base was not unified enough to get their populace into the nomination. It's not on the DNC elites, okay? That's not on the DNC elites. If anything, it's on grassroots organizers and the Democratic base. And we didn't have it together enough to unify around Bernie Sanders. Whether or not we should have unified around him is another question altogether. He would have been our Trump, okay? He would represent all the ideological solutions to our current problem. Not real solutions, ideological ones. I think they're better. I don't think they'll work, but I think they're better. But you can't just sit, you can't say, oh yeah, they're willing. No, the forces at work right now are, you know, more unified on the right. They're just, they are
massive. Of course they're more unified.
Did he literally just say they were more unified on the right?
Yes.
Did I hear that?
The populist base. I'm not talking about the RNC. Okay. I'm not talking about the RNC. I'm not talking about Bush and Glenn Beck and all of those people. Okay. I'm talking about the base.
But you see the base is actually right-wing in character, though. See, that's what I just got from you. Whereas I don't think it is. I think it's a burn the fuckers down moment.
I don't think it's
absolutely.
I don't think it's right-wing in character any more than the Democratic base is left-wing in character.
Doug, this is like the third or fourth. This is like the third or fourth one of these things I've lived through. Yeah. Like I'm talking about, you didn't have, like, we had Brexit here in England. That was like a pox on their houses vote. Yeah. And in Ireland, we had the Nice referendum where we voted to stop European integration. And we had to do that twice because Europe had to come in and say, no, you got to do this. Like these are like protest votes. And, you know, certainly a percentage of people were energized to do a racism. And maybe misogyny too, but to me that doesn't explain the thing at all. Another thing I'd like to say is that you know, we had the same. If you look to what's happening in Britain and look to what's happening in the United States, you've got the exact same thing happening. Over here, you've got like Jeremy Corbyn is the equivalent of Sanders. You had the left party, neoliberal parties. Split. One managed to hold it together in the US, and the other one, Jeremy Corbyn, got through. That's purely because of the electoral system, and then that the Labour Party has. And then on the other side, you have, say, the Conservatives here and the UKIP basically kind of causing some kind of a split on UKIP or on Brexit. And then on the American side, you got Donald Trump, who has essentially destroyed the Republican Party. Donald Trump, I heard him say this, I don't know how long ago, 6 months or a year ago, saying that in 5 years, he wants the Republican Party to be a workers' party. That's the scariest thing that we have. Because I know, Doug.
That's very scary.
I believe that's what's happening. And people are talking about, you know, I'm a white guy, blah, blah, but, you know, I do have a mixed race child. So I do have an interest in race relations and all that. But, you know, to me, it's a major thing. But to me, that's currently the minor thing, because what I think Donald Trump is going to do, and if he does this, it's very frightening. What he's going to try and do is he's going to try and implement MMT-style policies that I've been talking about on my podcast for ages, talking to MMTers, just like Hitler did. Hitler wasn't popular when he got in. And he's going to use his currency, and he's basically going to... Hitler built up a war machine to get people back to work, and Donald Trump is going to use it for probably some parts of war machine, but other infrastructure. And if he puts people back to work using the power of the currency, you know, and he gets unemployment right down and get good quality jobs, forget about the trade thing. Even if he just does infrastructure projects all across America, you know, you remember Dick Cheney said when George Bush was in power, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. Now, the minute Obama got into power, deficits mattered. But you can be sure the Republicans are very willing to switch back to deficits don't matter for building their infrastructure. And if he does that and he gets up massive infrastructure building all across America, just in his class interests as his type of capitalism, you know, as a real estate guy, that is the real fear, that he's going to be successful. And to me, I would not be surprised if he pours on these infrastructure projects like a New Deal type one And, you know, they may be negative. They mightn't be the type that Bernie was talking about. You know, it mightn't be green the economy. It could be freaking no coal plants or whatever the hell it's going to be. But if he does it and the economy gets flying, watch him get reelected and he won't have to play the race card the same way if he doesn't want to.
Well, here's the thing, though. The economy won't get flying.
Yeah,
at the end of a business cycle.
Yeah, what made Hitler's projects somewhat successful, I think, my understanding is that he had a war that was destroyed.
He didn't have a war. The main reason why he did it...
I thought he had.
What do you mean, like...
economy is what he had.
He basically did state-led investment. And just like any country can who has control over their own currency, they can do state-led investment, and the government debt doesn't matter because they can print their money.
Oh, yes. We see the specter of neo-Keynesianism again because you confuse money with value.
No.
This is what I'm saying.
This is not neo-Keynesianism. This is post-Keynesianism. And this is exactly...
Go on.
I don't think...
I'll articulate an argument in a minute, but go ahead.
because the reason is you can in currency and you can... It will not cause a problem if it's creating products that have value, that the society determines have value. And people in society definitely determine that infrastructure and bridges and roads and all that stuff has value. So the debt... You will not have inflation, and inflation is the only problem you have when you control your currency. He's going to send things, and it's going to be slightly more command and control, slightly more like a wartime economy. And if he does that, that's the problem.
I want to tag Derek in.
That only lasts for. That only lasts for 20 years. This is where I have a war with MMT. War with you post-Keynesians, because basically I think what you're doing is dangerous. The convolution of a generational cycle with a long business cycle is foolish. One, yes, that will work in the immediate term, but it doesn't actually produce long-term value unless you can produce commodities that can subtract for abstract, and there's going to always be a decline in that. You can only push command that for so long. And you see that in China right now. They can't command themselves out of their slow growth. It doesn't mean their economy's crashing. It doesn't mean that was all a failure, but it lasted about a generation. You saw that in North Korea in the 60s and 70s. It was outpacing South Korea for the same reason. You saw that in Russia in the transitions to the 50s. There have been such economies that existed. They never lasted more than 30 years. And MMT does not use enough long-term analysis to do anything about it. And I'm kind of tired of his popularity on the left, and I kind of wish these people would be discredited. The end.
Well, I disagree with you, Derek.
Yeah, I'm with Warren on this one.
The 2 years. Well, like, I consider myself a good Marxist, but that doesn't mean I'm not open.
Heretic.
Derek, what are you doing? I consider myself a good Marxist.
Heretic.
But I think Marxists are very wrong when it comes to understanding a currency. And the thing is, even if assume that I'm wrong, right? And let's assume that Derek is right, okay? And if you're saying, it can work for 20 years, well, that's long enough.
Well, I'm just saying it would be
that's
worse.
A long enough
I'm saying it would be system. Worse. I think in order for it to work, you're going to need an external enemy and a way to start.
You don't need an external enemy. Why don't you? You could literally say, I'm going to connect every major city in America to high-speed rail, and I'm going to do that, and it's going to create 5 million jobs, and it'll last 10 years to do it. He does that in the morning. There's no external war, and he's got a massive infrastructure thing going. And there's going to be value created there, and there's also going to be surplus created because it's going to be capitalists doing it.
Well, this is something we should like debate for a whole like I don't know year probably, you know, for a while.
Yeah, because I think we all like Doug and I are closer in this. We have our beliefs for different reasons. Doug is pure logical capital. I'm more historical, but
I'm logical.
Yeah, I know. Except you're really secretly a capitalist and you've outed yourself. even though you're a good Marxist, whatever.
Oh no!
Don't worry.
Here comes.
Don't worry. I'm a Bodega.
I'm lighting the steak right now, Tom.
I don't believe we should burn the heretics. I just believe we should, you know, re-educate.
Here, Derek, as Ryan Gott in the chat said. Did you see what Ryan Gott in the chat said? He's going to grab infrastructure by the pussy.
Oh God. Yeah, I will say this. I'll give you this though. The infrastructure is desperately needed in the United States, and I mean desperately. It's obscene. But you know, I travel around the world.
But then you go to the United States and you look at like the roads and the bridges. You're like, Christ Almighty, this is kind of like going to Brazil or somewhere.
Well, I mean, I do live in a country where the infrastructure is actually way, way worse. But North America in general's infrastructure is not nearly what it should be. And I include in that Canada, Mexico, and Belize. The bigger thing and the harder thing to deal with that is that the infrastructure is much older than in Europe for reasons of wars. And the infrastructure is much older than in Asia. But our infrastructure also is such a weird product of history that it doesn't make any damn sense. It creates all kinds of weird problems. Part of it's the size of the country, but not all of it. I mean, you go to any American city and its infrastructure setup actually almost demands that it be a suburb of itself and that the center sort of rots. And then once the center rots enough, it gets cheap, people run back in, they'll develop that, and then the outskirts will rot. It's not, which is what's happening right now. You're having an inversion cycle, but it's not set up to balance that out at all. And I think everyone knows it, but there's so much. You know, the funny thing about Trump, and this is going to be a problem for the left, and should be a problem for the left, is that we don't have any answers for we, as in the establishment version of us, or those who really work with establishment, for really how to do this, because we always have made excuses that it wasn't politically possible because of neoliberalism, because of right-wing opposition or whatever. Trump may do it with, like, John Bolton in his damn cabinet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Newt Gingrich is like Nixon going to his cabinet, too. Yeah.
It's Nixon goes to China moment. But, you know, Nick,
look,
have you ever met Derek? What are you doing there? It's very noisy.
I live in a major city.
Okay, sorry. It sounds like you're inside a pillow. But. you know, have you ever met a Republican, or for that matter, a Democrat, who said no to military spending?
No, I've never met anybody who said no to military and Keynesianism since the
80s. Yeah, yeah, and there hasn't even been that much of it since the only type of Keynesianism there's been is military Keynesian since then. There's never been non-military infrastructure. If he does, we're going to see 8 years of Donald Trump. Somebody, I can just ask people who are listening if they can give the show a thumbs up. That'll help out, and maybe a retweet or something. But here's something somebody asked. What about the Russia connection? What do people think about the geopolitics? Are we finished talking about the culture and economics? Do people want to say anything more there?
I mean, I want to just say that I think that the economic questions that we've been talking about are really important, not just to, in so much as they will predict, you know, whether or not Trump gets one or two terms, but also just to, you know, if we don't know what we think the foundational problems are, we're not going to, and we have an agreement, some kind of agreement, some level of agreement on that, then we're not going to be able to organize any kind of projects to address those problems. So
right, but we clearly don't. And to talk about this and maybe tie it into Russia,
okay?
Just because they're related, actually, in this weird way that it doesn't seem like they are. The left, and here I'm saying the radical left, the Marxist left, we don't have a common theory. I mean, look at what we just did. We just fought over MMT versus P
pure non-currency speculation. Basically, the post-Keynesian Marxist synthesis with the anti-Keynesian Marxist whatever.
Well, here, Derek, something's got to be said there first. Most of those post-Keynesian people don't agree with any type of value theory. And also, the Marxists who agree with it, they don't believe in a long-term falling rate of profit. But I do believe in a long-term falling rate of profit. And I am a value theorist. But I do think that there is a lack of understanding of how the currency works. And there is a synthesis there that is worrying for us if we look at what is likely to do. The last two or three Republican presidencies have expanded their deficit massively and say deficits don't matter. And we'd be naive to think Trump's not going to do the same thing and get growth up to 4 or 5%. That's, to me, is just what he will do.
I don't know if he'll get growth up to 4 or 5%. I mean, there's too much. The thing is that the economy is, even in this point of shrinking, that it currently is worldwide. I mean,
it's not shrinking.
Trade barriers are going up everywhere.
It's still growing.
But trade is...
The rate of growth is shrinking, right?
Yeah, the rate of growth is shrinking, and the rate of trade is shrinking actually fairly dramatically and fairly quickly.
But it's still, you know, the GDP in the countries is still up, you know, worldwide, I think the average is like 4%. In America, it's about 2%. So things are still growing. They're not shrinking.
Right. The rate of growth is what we're saying is...
What's the population growth?
I know, yeah.
What's the population growth?
I'm not sure. About 1%?
If the rate of profitability does not extend the rate of population growth, then you actually do not have a net growth. Just pointing that out.
But I fear that what we're going to end up with is if you're wrong about how successful Trump's policies can be, and I think you are, I think we're going to see massive reactions and scapegoating, both, you know, internally and externally, for U.S. problems. I see the Trump being a very violent administration ultimately.
I see the opposite problem. I see that he's going to be successful with his economics, which is going to give his other political views legitimacy, and that's the worry to me.
And I kind of cut the difference between you and think you're both a little bit wrong. But to go into that a little bit, and to get back to Russia, I think that Trump may actually be somewhat scapegoaty because he already is. I mean, the propellant of the campaign did begin with calling Mexicans rapists. I mean, like almost literally, that's what started it. Not all Mexicans, of course, but the ones that are over here. So well,
the ones that are coming into the country illegally, that's all he said. The guy,
right. But you notice that that's actually fallen away for the most part. They have talked about the wall, but the anti-Hispanic rhetoric has actually died down quite a bit. Anti-Muslim rhetoric has not. You need to put that in the context, though. And finally, we can get to Russia of the geostrategic stuff worldwide. Because while growth still exists worldwide, it is slowing. It is slowing down. It is particularly slowing down in the peripheral. The BRIC countries are hurting the most because they were the most reliant on mineral extraction. All right? That's true here in North Africa. That's true in Russia. It's not as true in China. That's true in Brazil. That's true in Venezuela. For Christ's sake, it's true in Venezuela. And that's true in India. All right? That's only going to get worse. That is going to be the ticking time bomb of the end of this business cycle. And we all agree that business cycles exist, right? We agree on that?
Yes.
Tom?
Yeah. The
you both.
Max, I've just done a talk with Michael Roberts about them.
Right. So, you know, I think we all even agree that there are long and short cycles, which is actually more controversial. But, right? I think we agree with this.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be a kind of statistical fact, but whether that's a systemic compunction or just our small data set, it's hard to know. These Kondratiev waves are 70 years long, and we only have stats. So It could be anything. It could be just not.
We have stats for 130 years. So you don't even have but one and a half of them. Yes. We only have valid stats for capitalism, and that's only really for Britain going back to 1870. There might be some better than that, but what I have found that's pretty decent goes back to 1870. Like, we know the average wages for British workers in the 1870s and 1880s. Anyway.
Can I just interject a meta comment at this point?
Go ahead.
Which is, you know, I think that, what's the name of this conversation? Like, the death of the wonks or something?
Yes.
And it seems like maybe that this has been the rebirth of the wonks, only on, you know.
The death of Wonktopia.
Yeah. Because, I mean, right now.
Yeah, but I mean, wonk dystopia. My wonkery only brings doom. No,
this is we're the wonk on dead. Doug, we're the wonk on dead.
Right, right. So, I mean, I think these conversations are important to have, I think. But the one of the problems that we have is, first of all, we can't all agree, but that's not, you know, I think we could work that out just with, if we all had long swords, but, or, you know, some sort of weaponry. But
we could just use our penises, say, for example.
Oh, then I'd be, you know, I would definitely lose. Well, actually, I don't know. You guys may not be that endowed. But the point here is, people other than us, you know, bizarre people like us, are fairly allergic, especially right now, to this kind of talk. It just reeks of, doesn't it? Just reek of elitism or of. I mean, what are your friends
what
in
do you
Georgia?
Mean?
Well, I mean, like, how patient are people on the left or the right with this kind of thought?
They're not. But this is actually a big problem. We get into one of the confusions we have with wonkery is trying to get perspective on a long durée versus trying to, like, lay out policies. And the problem with that is that this stuff is really unsexy. And it also doesn't make – I'm going to be frank with you. Doesn't make you feel good. The more you know about this, the more you realize the odds of good things happening according to a left perspective are remarkably low. They're not impossible, and they take a lot of understanding and effort. But trying to get people to do it is a problem. And, you know, when I said the death of Wonktopia, I was quoting my friend Amog. But to go into that a little bit more detail why I used it, is this is a rejection of policy as pragmatism, but it's not, I don't think it's a rejection of policy. I think Tom actually has a point. It might be, their policy might be horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But it's not a rejection of policy per se. It's not a rejection of history. I mean, although I've seen so many, like, superficial comparisons to 1932, and, you know, like, well, if the KPD and the SPD didn't hate each other, then they would have defeated the Nazis. Well, actually, we're not the KPD, we're not the SPD, and they hated each other for reasons.
And Trump is not Hitler. Trump, if anything, is
he is Hitler. He's absolutely Hitler.
Do you know who
he's Hitler? Like, Hitler.
Doug, you're a big fan of Zizek, and I'm not so much a fan of Zizek. But one thing he did say that I read a few years ago was that, you know, he was talking about what's the future of capitalism, and he was saying that Berlusconi is the future of capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what Trump is. Trump is closer to Berlusconi.
Trump is Berlusconi plus Andrew Jackson with a little bit of George Wallace mixed in.
And yeah, but George Wallace, if we remember, was
a dictocrat.
Yes, but his economic policies were a stimulus. Yeah. You know,
right.
And they were for the working man, you know, the white working man, but they were for the working man more so. And Trump has this amazing tactic. What he does is he says both sides of an argument. He'll say it one time and he signals it to some people, and then he'll say the opposite later on. So we don't know what he's going to do. But the very first thing he did say in the speech was that infrastructure. So I think he will go down that route. And whether you believe or I believe is wrong, I think we both think that we both believe it's going to work in the short term. I think they're going to work. They can work long term too. So that to me is a big thing. When we talk about Doug, is this wonkish? Like, let's put this into perspective, right? Like, we're from the Marxist left, right? That's pretty far out there. And then we're proponents of the falling rate of profit. So that makes us even to the wonks of the wonks. And then so we've got no chance.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, we are minority of a minority of a minority. And to make it worse, we're skeptical.
And you guys are putting me in my own minority then.
Right. And you're an MNT, so you're a heresy to everybody. It's okay. You're not under the realm of the God Emperor though, so I guess it doesn't matter. it's funny though that let's finally get to fucking Russia.
Okay.
Trying to for 20 minutes.
It's a long Russia, way to Russia.
There, this is why the problems with the geostrategic stuff needs to be really addressed. The Middle East in particular is solely dependent, or not solely dependent, with the exception of Turkey, mostly dependent on mineral extraction. That's true for Egypt. That's true for Saudi Arabia. It's not as true for Dubai and Qatar. Those are a little bit different. But nonetheless, that's what's driven them. They're running low. The United States played an interesting political game with them that's been under-commented on. There was this theory on the left that the United States was paying Saudi Arabia off to flood the market. That's not what was going on. This is the same thing that happened in the United States in 1920 in the 1890s to 1920 before Standard Oil really monopolized and what people don't realize slowed production down. Is the fear of losing profits and the fear of a loss of revenue stream has led Saudi Arabia to pump out more and more oil to get as much as it can out now so it can hope to build infrastructure itself for other kinds of industrial development later. Because without it, it's got nothing but sand and Mecca. It's got sand and Mecca. This has led it to be more aggressive militarily. But the thing about that, and this is another thing most people on the left, don't know much about, oddly don't know a whole lot about the world as much as they talk about Republicans not, is that they are increasingly aggressive religiously for a point of internal stability, but also in sort of minor areas to kind of expand and solidify territory because there's a chance that things are going to be more unstable in their own countries, both religiously and class-relatedly, because they're not as much money that these Saudis can basically dump into their own economy. Because of that, they have to wipe out these neighboring things like the Zaini Shiites
Come on, Derek, get there.
In Yemen. Anyway, the United States has taken a very weird tact where even though it's quote-unquote terrorist enemies are largely Sunni, that it has decided to risk a Sunni a Sunni megastate more or less by continuing to back up Saudi Arabia as a traditional ally. I'm not quite sure why we are doing it. There's a lot of rumbling both left and right against Saudi Arabia. Maybe and they're increasingly not important for oil.
I can tell you why we're doing it. It's because of that Clinton Foundation.
Oh yeah. Okay.
No, but the reason why they are doing it is that US doesn't actually get much Middle Eastern oil. It doesn't use it. It gets more from West Africa and from Venezuela and Mexico. It used to get it from and Canada, but it does it to control the rest of the world, which that is a very important place where they get their oil, particularly China. So the reason why they want to be there is not so much for their own; it's for geopolitical power reasons.
Did explain why they didn't try to do China and Iran. This is where, I think you're being naive again.
Sorry, say it again.
I think you're being naive. I
got that bit. I didn't get the first bit.
I said, well, why didn't they try to do more about Iran? The only good thing the Obama administration did, as far as my perspective for world peace, was to try to reach out to Iran a year ago.
Yes, but what's your problem?
It's really weird. I don't. That's a good thing. But my issue is why were they trying to do that? Because Iran,
I think they were going to be. go on. Sorry. You think Iran's going to be?
Iran's going to be the major supplier to Russia and China, even more than it already is.
But Russia doesn't need any supply. It's an exporter. China needs some supply, and Iran will be a major supplier there. But I think the reason is that America has understood that they can't fight multiple battles at once. So they want to finish the one they're doing with Syria, Iraq, whatever you want to call that. And after that, maybe they'll deal with Iran. But I think they basically, you know, Obama as a kind of a strategic chess player has decided we can't take on the Iranians right now. So we'll do one at a time. And I think that's purely it.
I tend to think you're overestimating the U.S. strategic command because their pivot to Asia was dumb. Their playing of insurgent forces in the Middle East have backfired every single damn time, and they continue to do it.
Yes, but it depends. It depends what you think they're trying to do. You know what I mean? Like you, if you look at what is happening in these places, you know, at some stage you got to go. Are they actually? Is that a design? You see, like the one thing that you do not want is people being independent. They don't want strong, independent states, you know?
Yes.
You know, they don't. They would really much prefer to have Al-Qaeda in a ragbag in power in Syria than a strong state. And so, and they don't want a state that's against their issues. They prefer Libya the way it is now. America does, maybe not Europe, but they prefer Libya the way it is now than it was under Gaddafi because he had to have some independent... You know, options for
Europe
action.
Led that more than America did. So
I know they did. Well, Hillary led it. Obama wasn't behind it.
Right, I know that was in the State Department's running of military policy. I'm aware.
I've leading this back to the Trump election. I've got a point for you guys. The thing I see about that's very, very interesting about this is that. You know, when the current international geopolitical system was set up, post-World War II, America was so dominant. And now, you know, they're just nowhere near the same dominance. They used to be 50% of GDP, now they're 25%. But most of the institutions still reflect their 1940s dominance. And
right,
when you've got a guy like Donald Trump, you know, these systems of power, they're so complex, you know, they're like big mounds of sand, you know, you add one more thing and then a bit falls off over here or there. It's impossible to predict. It's so complex. But like, it seems to me that Donald Trump, like, I don't know if you guys understand it. Well, you probably do, Derek, you're in Egypt, but like, say, Doug's in America, so he doesn't see it from a European point of view so much. But like in Europe, everybody's looking at Donald Trump and they're literally going, this guy is a tool. You know, he is a moron. You know, well, I don't think he's a moron. I think he's an asshole. You know, and they look at him, and every single prime minister, if they go over to America and they shake hands with Donald Trump, that is like political dynamite at home. You know, that's suicide.
Yeah, so, good. I hope Europe ends over this. It'll make me happy.
But I do think that when, you know, that kind of idea of Americans, you know, the American state having this kind of idea of being an ideological leader, you know, the world's policeman and all that, I think that's going to weaken a lot, that people won't see America as a moral force. You know, the irony is they do see America.
Who the hell sees America as a moral force?
Loads of people do. Loads of people do, Derek. That's just not even a thing to argue about. And like loads of people do. But when Donald Trump's in power there, we'll be able to see, I think we will probably see if...
God, you sound like a European elitist. All right, let's...
No.
I really am kind of
well,
tired.
Well, Theresa may have trouble shaking Donald Trump's hand.
Yeah, I mean, like...
No, she actually got really badly... Listen, because you boys are going
to win the French election in 2 years. I mean, come on.
Listen. Derek,
I am fine with the Europeans, by the way. I love you guys, and I know you're better than I am, so just go on.
No, we're not. We're not. You're just our slightly retarded cousin. But I'm joking. But Have you seen the headline of the Daily Telegraph today?
Oh yeah, I know they're going to do that. I
mean, yeah, well, this is
going to accelerate the problem for Europe because one.
But we're not no, talking about
it. Pulling out of NATO with Russia on your goddamn border. I mean, this is where
people in
Europe, for real.
No, but look, come on. Look at what happened when George Bush was in power. He was very unpopular in Europe. And when America went to war in Iraq, you had the French voting against it in the UN, and you had a lot of uproar. Now, Donald Trump is like George Bush times 100, guys. He really genuinely is. Not even the right wing in Europe, a lot of the right wing in Europe are against him. So when
because he's gauche. Yes, I understand.
That's true.
So that means that when America tries to apply coercive power in Europe and other places around the world, they won't have that moral standing. And I think we're going to see a realignment about certainly a more ease of independence of movement politically for other states. And that might. I think that might not be that bad. I'm not sure.
I mean, yeah, I look, that's wasn't that sort of what the Clinton campaign was saying all along? Like, this guy's not fit. He's going to embarrass us on the world stage. He's not, you don't want a reality TV
I'm star. So rolling my eyes. I really want to watch a counter argument here.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, you're right. Very few people.
Doug, are you finished yet? Did you finish, Doug?
Well, I was just going to say, yeah. I'm not arguing. I'm just saying, I don't see what the significance of that is for Derek, the left.
Sorry, Derek, you need to mute yourself when you're not talking because it's really, really badly interfering. But sorry, Doug, continue there.
I just don't see the significance of that for the left exactly. I mean, so European leaders are going to be embarrassed to be seen with Donald Trump. We won't have the moral force that we once had, which, to my mind, might be not even a bad thing if you're talking about trying to organize an illegal invasion of Iraq. It wasn't bad that Bush couldn't do it.
But Bush could do it.
Barely,
so,
right?
So I mean that, this might actually weaken America's ability to act like they did in Iraq.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's a positive thing for the left. But also, we're just discussing about what are the implications of a Trump.
But I think the argument against that is Theresa May and Le Pen and others who are going to be rising up just like Trump. I don't think Europe is off the hook as far as having the same kind of right-wing populist reactions bringing people just as disreputable into power as Trump. I mean,
well, look at all the all of them. Like, I just saw a selection of the right wing, both tabloids and broadsheets in the UK, and an awful lot of them were slating Trump. Yeah, full page headlines slagging him off. That has never happened before. That's never happened for any US president, and it's never happened certainly for a right wing president. That's unprecedented. That's unprecedented. There has never been somebody like Trump.
And the UK has also never been so irrelevant, but we can continue.
But yeah, I'm not saying, I'm Irish, so I don't give a crap. But I'm just saying about how America is perceived. Like, the Irish press is going ballistic. They're saying,
of course you are.
They're saying the Prime Minister, Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, shouldn't go over to America on Patrick's Day. That's been done every year for 100 years. They're saying, how can we send somebody over there to Donald Trump? They're going to boycott his businesses.
I'm fine with that because I think that's going to accelerate the destruction of Europe. It was more my point.
I don't think it's
just the United States is going to. You have this Chomskyite worldview that this has all been America's elite dominating everything, and somehow Europe wasn't complicit in this the entire fucking time.
No, I think they were secondary. They were not the main drivers of power, but they're secondary. Look where the U.S. bases are. We don't have European bases in America. We've got American bases in Europe. That's a good indicator of who's right in the driving seat.
And this is political determinism. Again, not very great Marxism on your part, but
it's not a simple yes or no. I'm just saying that America is the dominant power. when, you know.
And yes, and we are not going to be anymore.
In a way, this is an argument for Trump, right? I mean, you're saying, okay, because Trump's going to be more of an isolationist. Trump will make America.
Thomas is making arguments for Trump the entire time.
I'm not making an argument for him. I'm just discussing this one. I know. This is terrible. You know, this is terrible. But, like, I'm just saying.
I know. I didn't want to point out that this is the second time you've sided with this fascist Donald Trump, but it is.
I'm gonna stop broadcasting. No, I'm joking. I'm just trying to talk about what are these implications, you know, because I think that's a major implication. You guys probably don't. I don't know if you agree with it, or maybe you think we shouldn't talk about it just because it's positive in some light.
No, I mean, I don't have a problem talking about positive things about Trump. I don't have a problem talking about positive things about any of this. What complicates this is Russia. What complicates this all the way around is Russia, because Russia is more aggressive right now than it's ever been. It has every economic reason to be so, particularly if you're right. Because if you're right, Tom, then they need their war economy.
It doesn't
That's
need
how they're
going to
justify their building. Yeah, well, but it's going to be.
I think it's going to be a combination of war and infrastructure.
In Russia or in the United States? I think in the United States, yes.
Yes,
in Russia. In Russia, I think it's going to be war. They already have plenty of infrastructure, although I'm not sure how good it's doing. I haven't been to Russia.
In Russia, their infrastructure is pretty crap, I think. I don't know what it's going to be like in Russia. Russia is more neoliberal. See, Trump's not a neoliberal. Whatever the hell he is, he's a neo-fascist, but he's not a neoliberal.
But Putin the thing is Putin's not either. Putin's not really neoliberal. I don't think so. I think he's been playing those two sides off each other internally in United Russia. That's why Dugin was appointed so high in the Moscow University for so long, and then that's why he was sacked. That's why the Medvedev, who was a neoliberal, was promoted, and then his portion of the party was basically purged. I really don't think, one, even that Europeans have been following Russian politics very closely, and two, because of that, they're misreading the situation. To get back to Putin, Putin is playing the same great game the United States is. You know, you've even had people, and I'm going to call you out. You've had people on your podcast that are fronts for him.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Fronts. Yeah, I did not know that.
And it's funny.
Did you find out that was true, Tom? Did you like verify that he was a front guy?
Well, no. Derek pointed me out to some sites that he was writing for. You know, that
the sites were fronts. I don't know that the dude is actually a front.
No, but he did say some things that were a bit strange. Like Putin is a traitor, you know, and that.
Yeah, Putin is a traitor because he wouldn't have nuclear war with the United States.
But he didn't exactly say that. But
that's pretty close to what he said.
Close, but one of these Marxists who believe that we can only get to communism.
No, he's an anti-NATO person. No, he's an anti-NATO person.
Right.
With who writes for a lot of sites that do get Russian money. That I can say for sure. I can't say anything about him personally, and I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to slander the guy if I'm wrong. But I do know the sites he was writing for get Russian money explicitly. Things like global research.
Can I throw out an idea or just throw out an observation that might shift us a little bit? What I've noticed is that there are two different kinds of concerns at work in this conversation. On the one hand, there's the concern that I have because of my Facebook wall, which is
Derek, can you mute yourself? Because it's very hard to hear when you're not talking. Okay. Sorry, continue.
Well, how do we deal with basically the less nuanced, you know, less ideological parts of the left that are so easily, I'll call it like from Bernie Sanders to the left, who are very easily just sort of channeled into the Democratic Party, who are now demoralized and sort of, you know, talk about losing moral authority, who've lost their moral authority in this moment. How do we stop that kind of self-pitying overreaction and start to try to rebuild and figure out a way forward? There's that kind of conversation, which maybe is profoundly naive. And then there's this conversation about how should we do our left analysis? Is there any good side to Trump? I'm almost hearing like maybe we need to align ourselves with aspects of Trump's agenda, which I think is very dangerous, incredibly dangerous. So those are like the two kinds of conversations. Are they at all overlapping, or is this, you know, just completely?
Yeah, they're overlapping. I mean, here's the thing. I haven't talked about this much except privately with you guys, but it's important to note that while the first generation of alt-rightists that I know all came from the right, they came from the paleoconservative movement. They were too racialist for them. The second generation has all come from either libertarians or former Marxists. They're not neoliberals at all. And they viewed Trump as an opportunistic way to jump ahead. Now, to bring that back, why did that happen? Why has it been so hard to counter? Well, to get back to Russia and all these things, until a year ago, every leftist and liberal that I knew loved Russia Today, almost like stupidly so. All right, because it confirmed parts of their worldview. They didn't pay attention to the parts of it that didn't. They didn't pay attention to the fact that Richard Spencer, for example, could get on Russia Today, and nobody else would talk to the alt-right. They didn't pay attention to any of that. But they definitely liked the confirmation view about the discontent in the United States, particularly against Republicans. And then when it was clear that it was in Putin's interest, and we talk about geostrategic weakening, to sort of push someone like Trump, for some of the reasons that I think Tom agrees. My issue with Tom is not that I think he's wrong about America, it's that I think he's wrong about Europe. I mean, it's not that I think America is going to gain a whole lot of prestige. I know that a whole lot of the Europe is not being willing to shake his hand, but that doesn't matter anymore.
That's where you're wrong, Derek. Like, things like that do matter. You know, at the American standing, however you want to put it, some of their power in the world is a function of their propaganda. And Trump has turned their propaganda on its ass.
Let's just move on. I mean, there's no way getting the, you know, I see the point here.
Well, no, I mean,
Europe doesn't matter here. Is the point. Like, America's falling, so is Europe. Things are becoming more even across the globe. So
yes, exactly.
That's my point, right? I mean, so the reason why it doesn't matter whether or not Europeans are going to shake Donald Trump's hand is because maybe he wants to shake Putin's hand. Maybe he's more concerned with China. You know, maybe Europe is not the number one person that the United States is going to be worried
about.
Yeah,
you could just be the little dingly bit off of Eurasia anyway. I don't know. I tend to think European self-importance is mirrored by American self-importance only in that it gets a scapegoat, usually. And
American self-importance is the biggest self-importance in the world.
Absolutely, without a doubt. Let's move on to what Doug was talking about. What can we hope about? Let's leave this Russia stuff behind, because obviously we're just saying the same thing or arguing all the time. What is the hopes for these people who have maybe been taken into the Democratic Party after the Sanders thing? And from my point of view, having gone through Ireland went through a kind of very traumatic election in 2008, 2009, when everything fell apart, that the main party, which would be the equivalent, it wouldn't be an equivalent in America, but it would have been like the Republicans and the Democrats put together. It basically lost 3/4 of its vote. Now, and, you know, that allowed a space for other parties to come in. I know we got proportional representation. But it feels like to me that something like what has happened here is going to could lead to a split in the Democratic Party. Either internally it'll split and it'll be caught up like the Labour Party and not able to function, or it might actually split and we might see something happening. What would you guys think about that?
Dear God, I hope it. I don't think it's going to happen, the latter, but I hope the hell it happened.
What about the former?
The former is almost inevitable. The problem is that the election law in the states is handled on a state-to-state basis, and it's been built up by a kluge by the parties before the election laws were even there. So it's very hard to imagine, barring a civil war, which is what happened the last time we had a major party realignment, something like this happening. Now, I'm not predicting a civil war in the United States, even though some liberals seem to think that it's now inevitable. I just really think that it would require the left to do something that I don't see it doing in the US, because I didn't see it doing it in the UK. I haven't seen it doing it in the Anglosphere, period. And that is really go after, and I mean really go after, any collaboration with a bourgeois party that required you to become a member. And I just don't see it. I don't see it because I don't see them being willing to – I don't see them being willing to – in general being willing to risk alienating unions and whatever in the United States. Not that unions really matter, because they only make up about 19% of the working force and only about 7% or so of the non-government working force. But and they tend to only be in coastal elite areas too, and there's a whole bunch of issues with that. But it's just, I don't see that happening because of the entrenchment of the leadership of the the American labor movement, in so much that it even exists within the democratic apparatus. I just can't see them doing that. But they will go to Cold War to explain within themselves to explain what happened.
I have a question for the two of you guys. I am a big for my sins. I'm a very big boxing fan, and I was listening to a boxing podcast. And at the end of the podcast, it's about some UK guys and some American guys, and they were talking about the US election for the last few minutes. And just like two normal punters, no political aficionados or anything, were talking about how the DNC screwed over Bernie, and like a pox on both their houses, essentially, the both of them were saying. Like, do you think that narrative is mainstream in America? And do you see it have an effect, or do you think that it'll just be propagandized away and we'll forget about it?
I'm going to jump in and say it is a talking point on the liberal left side of the Democratic Party. You'll see it in various venues. You probably see it in Democracy Now. It even comes up in more mainstream venues when you have little round tables of pundits talking. And I don't think it's going to have any influence on the future of the kinds of candidates we'll see, or the kinds of policies we'll see coming out of what's left of the Democratic Party. There was a big conversation up until the election day about how the Republican Party had been completely decimated, and fractured and blown to bits. And that obviously is not true, because not only did Trump win, but
I think it is true. I think what was the Republican Party?
Trump not only did Trump win, but the Republicans, held on and even expanded their power in the House and Senate. What remains to be seen is what kind of internal battles will go on in the Republican Party. But as a power, the Republican Party is actually the winner in this election cycle. And I think that will continue to be the case, for at least the next 4 years or actually at least the next 2 years.
Here's a follow-up question, Doug, to say you said that you don't think that – you think that people know about it, but you don't think it'll have any effect if they know that, say, the DNC are largely responsible for the Donald Trump we have now, or for Bernie's – certainly for ditching of Bernie. But so do you not think that if people are aware that it might affect how people organize, that they might see that the Democratic Party is – essentially useless? We had all these people that came from the black movements and a lot of people. One of the guys from the Black Agenda Report I heard talking the other day, people who are probably close to the Black Panthers, who ended up going back in to try and reform the Democratic Party for 20 years, and they got nowhere. Do you think that people will, you just think it'll just fall apart, or do you think they'll just end up being co-opted again?
They got co-opted the last two cycles. I don't know why this would be any different.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'll go. Yeah, go ahead, Varn.
I mean, I don't want to credit liberals for with a total lack of imagination. I do think it's going to have some effect, but it's going to have some effect within the corridors of an internal, you know, war with progressives. And that's about the start. I mean, I have friends around the Red Party in the United States, which is a very small party, and the Socialist Party around the United States. And they pretty much declared a no-holds-barred war on Democrats as of today. You know, blaming them for Trump. And I kind of think they're right to do that in spirit, but I don't know what effect they can possibly have. You're talking about groups with like 400 or 500 members, if I'm being optimistic, and probably more like 80. Now, in the larger war in the DNC, who knows? I mean, the problem with the DNC in some degree is while its undercoteries are young, there was not a single face on that stage ever, including Bernie, that was younger than 65.
President Obama.
Yeah, sure. Not anyone who's going to be in power anymore. President Obama's seems to have been put out the pasture. In fact, he's been seen to put out the pasture before he's even done, as is normally the last year. But I mean, he's not seemed very relevant in this at all.
Right.
He didn't promote anyone young. He didn't build up any new cadres. The closest thing they got was Van Jones, which got run out to MSNBC. I mean, there's not a whole lot he's going to have to show for building up his wing of the party, because he pretty much gave it all to Clinton in anyway. The Biden-Kerry wing didn't really do anything, and they're also old. I mean, so I don't know where those ashes are going to be picked up. What I'm more interested in is whether or not people can admit that was even a problem. I mean, and in some ways, I kind of want the Democrats to split. I really would hope that they would split. But knowing what I know about the structure of American law, that doesn't seem very likely. There's way too many. There's 50 barriers to change, not one.
Yeah, that's why I think the entryist kind of option is probably the most likely to succeed, like it is for, say, Corbyn in the UK. In the chat, we had Toby Kamor said, what about Cory Booker?
Can I just insert a groan? Okay.
Yeah, Cory Booker, you know, everyone's favorite neoliberal that, sure.
I don't even know where he is, so that shows you.
He's a African-American governor. Anyway, he was a key figure, but you notice he's not on the national stage. You will notice he was not ever considered as even a presidential VP. I mean, if you look at the list of Clinton's VPs, it was the most milquetoast people and the most like edgy white liberal people you could find. There was never a moment where there's going to be any concession to even Obama's wing of the party, which is what you're talking about with Cory Booker, much less, you know, Sanders's people are Elizabeth Warren and people like Michael Moore and a lot of people. You know, Michael Moore actually sort of explained what was going to happen with Trump, and also have been, you know, close to demonizing Clinton for months, and then had to celebrate his voting for her.
What happened to him? Did he get some sort of lobotomy, or what the hell was that? I've never seen him more artificial than that. I mean, it was disgusting.
What was?
Oh, he made a little movie a couple of days before the election.
It was painful.
Where he had to stand up and say, I love mom. She's going to be great because she's mom. And you should vote for mom. It was just gross.
Explaining why no one would.
Right. Explaining very well why the kind of nihilistic hatred of the establishment that was behind the Trump phenomenon. He then went on to give these really unconvincing arguments about how important that it was to elect the first woman president on that basis alone, on no other basis.
Guys, we've been on for an hour and a half now. What have we not covered? Is there Brian Mayne here? Well, I must say, somebody in the chat said earlier, who was a Wizard Gherkin, said, how long is it till Tom wears a red hat? I've got my Make America Great hat in the post. Brian Mean in the chat also said, whatever happens next will be to the... Sorry, Derek, can you mute there, please? It's a bit... he said, whatever comes next will be to the Democratic Party what the Republicans were to the Whigs. What do we make about that? Anybody want to comment on that?
Civil War. No.
I just don't agree with that. I just don't see that happening. But
yeah. Okay. So, is there anything we haven't covered yet? Because I don't want to go on too much longer.
There's so much we haven't covered, and yet I really don't feel like talking about it. we can easily get lost in the weeds. I think the biggest thing that we're going to need to look for, we do have an open open rejection of policy wonks. At the same time, as you said, it actually in favor of policy. Like the weird thing about all this pragmatism is how unpragmatic and unwonky it actually was.
Disagree. I disagree. I think it's all very practical. A lot of it is practical.
You mean the Clinton rhetoric?
No. I'm talking about Trump.
No, I'm talking about the Clinton rhetoric. I'm saying that like there was no real. They're the party of wonks. They're the party of policy. Like that's when the Democrats bread and butter forever. They had nothing on the table. Nothing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But they have a very specific type of policy, a policy that is designed to sound good but not do anything. I don't know if anybody.
I basically agree with you. I mean, I kind of conceived of them as putting themselves in the position of trying to strike a balance between, you know, neoliberal deregulation and intervention into the banking system and regulation to try to keep the tiny bit of bubble going that we have in the economy, looking to, you know, the low unemployment rate and the other indicators as justification for this sort of mixed bag, wonky, managerial kind of position that, you know, was actually quite dangerous. But that's what I think they offered. And Trump offered a lot of big ideas. I don't think that the majority of them were at all practical. I don't think there are many practical solutions within the system we have. I mean, I'm kind of simple-minded about this. I think that all these problems that we're having stem from the same source, which is that there are eternal contradictions in capitalism, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is a party line for me, but it also happens to be what I believe to be the facts. And so I don't know exactly what how we should be organizing around that. My hope at the moment is just that people on the left, if they think of themselves as on the left, can stop fighting along these cultural lines long enough to take a look at the underlying conditions and to dare to think about it. I mean, it's little that I'm asking, and I know it's just like, again, that's a slogan, but it's what I've got.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said there, Doug, that I presume we all agree that, you know, it's not Debbie Wasserman is to the fault, you know, it's nobody's fault. The real person's problem fault is the falling rate of profit.
Well, no, it isn't. Not if you think that, you know, you can just print your own money and solve all your problems for, you know, 40
years. Well, I do think that is a way out of the falling rate of profit, and we can talk about that another day. But is there anything else that we haven't touched on that we want to touch on before we wrap up?
Well, I think it's interesting to see one of the things we haven't talked about that I brought up in the beginning is the whiteification of people of color. And I'm using that word in specific, but people have completely, the cultural left have completely misunderstood, and have people that on their own communities, the identification of people of color in the United States with the Democrats and as a coherent group. Hispanics, you know, if George Zimmerman doesn't teach you that Hispanics can become white, I don't know what does.
I mean, I agree with you. But look, you know, there's a lot of right-wing Cubans in Florida, and they, you know, always vote Republican. that, you know, this idea that they're, you know, if you're black or you're brown, you have to be Democrat is a fallacy.
Right. And as the demographics of the United States change, those communities will become more diverse. That's the true. Only people who I can't, you know, who I say things usually get the crap under the stick are the people who cannot whitify, and that's the African-American community that, like, they're by default in the United States the group of which you can never, you know, normalize into the white community, because by definition that's really all that white means. It's not black.
Do you know, like, one thing I gotta say, boys, is that, you know, we've been on for an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes now, and it's three white blokes here, and we've never once mentioned the term misogyny. Hardly. We haven't talked about sexism in this conversation at all.
Yeah, that's big. And I don't know.
Well,
there's going to be reams of paper spilt on this, actually, for years. And I'm going to shut up so Dad can talk, and I'll talk.
I'll just say something that's not very politics, but I think that it's really the problem with talking about misogyny and gender issues in regards to this election is that both sides played the gender card so obviously in such disgusting ways that I think any self-respecting feminist would have been completely turned off by Clinton, and all but the most kind of deluded MRAs should have been turned off by Trump. I mean, it just the gender war here was so, it seemed entirely manufactured to me. I mean, I don't think that someone like Elizabeth Warren, who I don't agree with in a lot of ways, on economics especially, but I don't think someone like Elizabeth Warren would have had the same difficulties that Clinton did. She may have suffered some of the same sexist remarks or sexist attacks, but she would have weathered them fine. And Clinton was particularly vulnerable to them because it was all she was running on. So, I mean, that's probably not the most enlightened perspective, but that's mine.
I think there's a lot going on here as far as misogyny goes. And the other thing is the feminist community itself was fairly divided on this. I mean, nobody was in support of Trump. But Trump wouldn't have won if he didn't have some women voters. There's just no way around that. So one of the things people are going to have to ask themselves, why would a woman vote for Trump?
I heard a statistic today that a majority of third level educated white or third level educated women voted for Trump.
I happen to know a woman who voted for Trump. She's my she's an in-law, and she's in her 60s. She's educated. In fact, she's gone back to school because she can't get work, and she's just sort of trying to. This is a story I tell a lot, but it's an important one. She's just needs the loans to survive. She's no real expectation she's going to have a career for any length of time at all, if at all, after she's done with school. She's lengthening out her school stay as long as possible, and she voted for Trump not because she's not a feminist, not because she doesn't think that a woman should be in power, but because for the same reason anybody would vote for Trump. She wanted to blow up the establishment, which had put her in this position of being sick most of the time, unemployable, and basically conning her way into survival. So that's why I think a lot of women might have voted for Trump was because they feel that way.
So I've got another stat for you guys. From what I saw today on The Guardian about a couple of hours ago, that Hillary actually won the popular vote.
Yeah.
I've heard that. I've heard that too, but I've also seen another statistic that had Trump winning it by 1.9%. And I actually need to go and look at the numbers. We won't know for sure for probably another 24 hours, honestly, who really won the popular vote. I'm not surprised if she did, and that's going to make things even more fun. But to be honest, that's also not surprising because of the patterns of development in the United States. It's another thing we haven't talked about, but that's going to really complicate things. The rural-urban divide has become more severe in the U.S., like it has pretty much everywhere. And the rural area has gotten really decimated in the last 10 years. I mean, really bad. You know, and I, like I said, I grew up near that. I've seen it. And but the cities are the centers of population, and they tend to be blue. I can't – for the same reason I can't see the Democrats splitting up, I also can't really see them having enough ground game to really do anything about the rural-urban divide, nor that they even seem to want to. I don't know why. I actually really don't understand that. But because they have been losing state-by-state elections since Obama, you know, since actually the second term after Obama – pretty consistently, and during redistricting years a lot of the times. And they haven't been playing the game hardly at all at a state level. If you look at the number of, like, for example, Democratic governors to Republican ones, it's actually kind of severe, the difference. That's not going to be changed anytime soon. Even if Hillary did run the popular vote, and I'm not saying she didn't. I think she probably did, actually. The long-run effect of this is going to be what exactly? Like, because the same reasons I can't see the Democratic Party really being split is the same reasons I can't see them reforming re-election laws is the same reason why I can't see – so there's so many things I can't see under the current system. There's so many chokeholds. So with all that said, you're going to have to really reimagine, like, trying to fight to get rid of the Electoral College of the United States. That requires a constitutional amendment or a fucking convention, a constitutional convention, which, you know, we've never had since the first one, which was illegal.
Well, Derek, let's not go there. Guys, I'm going to have to go. It's been 1 hour, 47 minutes.
Be done with this.
Okay. Very good. Marxist slash
that was nice.
Trump-loving conversations. I'm going to put this up on, it'll be on the YouTube. It'll also go on the Podomatic. And Doug, you're going to.
I'll put it on Zero Squared. Yeah, I probably won't even edit it. I'll just.
Me too. I'm not going to edit. I'm just going to put it straight up. I mean, it'll be full of Derek shuffling every 5 minutes, Busher. What
can
we do, Derek?
You know, there you go.
Yeah.
It was. I want to ask you one thing before you. What do you think about the misogyny issue? I know that's. I'm not letting you go, but just answer that yourself, and then, if you would.
Me? What do I think of misogyny?
About the misogyny issue. Obviously, you're against misogyny. But the misogyny in this campaign.
Well, I think it's like, it's weird. I think Hillary displayed misogyny towards Donald Trump's wife. I think there was definitely like sexist attacks against her. And then Donald Trump is an obvious misogynist / sex pest, I suppose the best way to put him. Right. You know, and I think that, you know, I think people, in the end of the day, they didn't care about it. I think they look at a lot of the parties and all these politicians, and there's lots of them come out with, you know, whether it's Wiener or whether it's Bill Clinton, and they end up coming out with sex, you know, things. And I think they just kind of go, they're all the same, and they kind of ignore it. But I do think it's going to have a bad impact on what people think is acceptable behavior, as opposed to whether I think Donald Trump got loads of, you know, misogynists giving him votes. I don't think he probably did.
All right.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Just wanted you to have to weigh in since you hit that hot button and then put us on.
Yeah, no, I just thought that, I never have female guests on my show because I'm reading economic stuff the whole time and I never get to talk about that stuff. And I don't consider myself able to talk about it, but my missus, there you go, that's some misogyny for you. My partner always gives out to me for it, and so does my mother. So I thought I should at least include 1 minute of it at the end. Guys, thanks very much.
All right.
And, thank you.
And sure, we'll talk again.
All right.
Maybe we should do this more often.
Yeah.
It's good fun.
All right.
Yeah. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye now.